I'm Jordan Palmer, and you're listening to Interconnected Voices. I'm a freelance jeweler, and I'm 21, and yeah, I'm trying to find something else that's spicy to say about myself, but it's not really.
I'm light skinned and I'm cute. That's the next spicy thing
LSC,
to say.
LSC. I think first time I kind of realised was, I'd probably say college, because in college I was just a bit more like, I'd say a bit more uncomfortable than I was in secondary school. In college, it was kind of like a stage of where I was like, everyone else is growing into people, and I just didn't feel like I could grow into the person that I was born into, if that makes sense. So it was literally a weird feeling, and it was just kind of a bit like, whoa, I would not see myself like this in 5 years'
time.
What is actually going on? Like, what's wrong? Do you know what I mean?
I completely hear you, yeah.
At the same time, because I was in a very biased home, it was just very hard for me to even understand myself.
It wasn't
what was
an
going
option,
on.
Basically.
It wasn't an option at all. It was just like, how could that... Do you know what I mean? How has God produced that? That doesn't make sense. You can't really explain it like that, so it doesn't really exist, and that's it.
So at the time when you were at college, were people calling you Jordan?
It was still Abby in college, and then it changed. Grow into the person that I was born into, if that makes sense. No, actually, yeah, I went all the way through college, and then I dropped out in my second year, because then that's when I was like, whoa, I can't do this anymore, kind of thing.
Do you think at this time where you was kind of feeling overwhelmed, if you accessed NHS services then, do you think it would have impacted your self-discovery from Abigail to Jordan and made it easier?
If I'm honest, I honestly feel like the NHS didn't really help as much as I thought would actually help. So when I turned to the NHS, it was more of like, I don't know, I wouldn't say I wanted them to save me, but it was more of like, I need like mega help here. And it was kind of a very slow process of, you know, like appointments and waiting lists, and it was just very slow, and it was a lot slower than what I thought it'd be.
You are now locked into Interconnected Voices.
Interconnected Voices.
Hello, you're listening to Interconnected Voices. What would Labour do? A special series where we speak to young people about their experience of interacting with our political system and ask them, how might life be different under Labour policy? This is a quote from the House of Commons Women and Equalities Committee Report 2019. There are unacceptable inequalities in health outcomes for the LGBT plus community that glare out wherever you look. At the same time, the NHS was a major talking point in the last election.
The NHS is front and centre in the run-up to polling day.
With all kinds of promises made about extra GPs, reduced waiting times, and even evidence that Boris Johnson was in talks with Trump about the NHS.
Market access for US products to our National Health Service. You're going to sell our National Health Service.
So how do these two things fit together? What kinds of experiences are marginalised groups having when interacting with our healthcare system? And as the coronavirus pandemic continues, how worried should we be about the ability of the NHS to provide the care that people need? I'm Cherise, and in this episode of Interconnected Voices, I'll be looking at how 10 years of Conservative-led government has affected the NHS. Specifically, we'll be taking a deep dive into what it's like to seek treatment from the Gender Identity Clinic to undergo a gender transition. For those of you that don't know, transgender people have a gender identity that differs from the sex they were assigned at birth. So let's start with Jordan's story and his experience of seeking help from the NHS. What was your process? Did you go to your GP first and then get referred to the Gender Identity Clinic?
Yeah, so the first time I kind of took it medically seriously, it was quite weird, but I basically told my parents, and they was like, they didn't really understand what was going on either. But because I went to them and I was basically like, all right, cool, this is how I feel. Mm-hmm. I want to go to the doctor to talk about it and see what's going on and see what's the next steps. because I don't feel normal at all. And my mum actually took me to the GP, but I remember in the GP she was saying things like, yeah, but she doesn't really understand it herself and she's not really with it herself. She's just here to kind of like sort out my tantrums, if that makes
sense. Basically yeah. trying to maybe trying to steer you away from how you actually feel, like,
yeah,
like you are overreacting kind of vibe.
Yeah. I remember as well, the GP didn't even know what was going on either. So when we were actually talking about like my whole situation and stuff, because I was actually telling her, yeah, this is what we need to do for the whole reference and the whole application, the whole, all of these kind of things. And she was like, oh, okay. Do you know what website this is on? And like, it was literally very uneducated.
Jordan's experience of a GP who was unsure about how to help is not uncommon. Stonewall found that more than half of trans people in the UK said they had been told by their GP that they do not know enough about trans-related healthcare to provide it.
I literally had to educate her on everything, and she went through the application and she was just like, you know, answering and ticking the boxes and then and then after that, I think I got I feel like I was very depressed after that, because she said there was like a waiting list of like a year minimum. To have the first appointment. That's when I was like, whoa, like, what is actually the point? Because, you know, I'm literally throwing myself at the NHS now, and there's not even like in between counselling, or there's not even, do you know what I mean? There's literally, all right, cool, reference, all right, cool, and that's it for a year. Then you get a phone call after a year, literally after
no
a year.
No way.
Yeah, after a year. And then it's the gender identity clinic basically wanting to do their first assessment.
In the past 10 years, referrals to gender identity clinics have been increasing. In 2009, only 97 patients were referred to gender identity services. By 2017, this has increased to 2,519. This is mainly due to the better social awareness of gender fluidity. People nowadays just feel more able to seek the help they need.
I've never been comfortable with she. I've never been comfortable with Abigail. I've never been comfortable with like any of these things. And then I remember I watched the documentary, and after that documentary, I was like, wow. Is this actually like my situation? Because this is exactly how I feel, and this is how I felt my whole entire life, thinking that I'm an absolute weirdo. And then I watched that documentary and I was like, wow, like there's actually other people in the world that think like this. Because before that, I didn't even have a clue what transgender was at all. Like,
really?
I didn't even know you could like change yourself. I literally thought I was dying, unhappy, like the way I am. Like, but yeah, when I found out, I was so glad, but yeah.
Unfortunately, funding and resources have not kept up with these needs. And this has resulted in much longer waiting times for individuals being referred. Although you are legally supposed to be seen within 18 weeks of referral, in reality, the wait is so much longer. Our research found anecdotes of individuals waiting 3 or more years for one appointment. It's worth pausing here for a moment and reflecting on waiting lists and resources NHS-wide. The Health Foundation found that essential parts of the NHS in England are experiencing the worst performance against waiting time targets since targets have been set. For example, waiting times in A&E are at their worst since 2004, with a huge proportion of people waiting 4 hours or more to be seen.
The way that things have become in A&E over the last 2 years, you know, we're at breaking point. It can't carry on.
But why is this?
By post-2008 austerity.
Yes, austerity.
It's been more austerity, Prime Minister.
I wish there was an easier way, but I have to tell you, there is no other responsible way.
In fact, a slashing of NHS services to fund the bank bailout was a political choice.
In short, it's because we've seen a decade of austerity policies, meaning cuts to the NHS. Now, you might have heard Boris Johnson making promises about a cash injection to the NHS in the 2019 election, saying things like,
"We're investing massively in the NHS, the biggest investment for a generation."
But when we dig behind the numbers, we see that the last 10 years have seen the weakest annual increase in funding for health services since the NHS was founded. The amount of money that goes into health services has been climbing for the past 60 years, but the percentage increase that each government invests varies. For example, under Thatcher, it was a 3.3% increase in funding. Under the Labour government of the noughties, it was 6%. In the past decade, that percentage is just 1.3%, the lowest it's ever been.
10 years ago, I never once nursed a patient in the corridor.
The Conservatives have also failed to deliver on promises they made in 2015 to have 5,000 more GPs working by this year. There's actually 1,608 fewer full-time GPs working now than in 2015. That makes it really hard for me to trust claims that they made in 2019 about bringing 6,000 more GPs to the NHS, especially when you consider that it takes 10 years to train a GP and nearly one in two GPs plan to retire in the next 3 years. It would be strange here not to mention the ongoing pandemic and that confidence in the government is failing around their ability to deal with the crisis. There is also evidence that the government ignored key recommendations made in a 2016 report that found the UK's plans, policy and capabilities was currently not sufficient to cope with the pandemic. When it comes down to it, the NHS has an amazing level of public support. No political party would jeopardise votes by jeopardising their commitment to the NHS.
I believe very passionately in I use it, I love it.
But if we dig behind the political rhetoric, the numbers speak for themselves. Coming back to Jordan, we see that this kind of policy leaves marginalised groups on the sharp end of cuts. He was left waiting for a year, which for him had a detrimental effect on his mental health.
I think just especially in the first year, because that was the most kind of like crucial year of trying to find out what was going on. And like I really, really declined, I think, in my mental health in that year, because it was just kind of like I felt like I lost all hope, because it was kind of like the NHS just doesn't really try like that. Do you know what I mean? So
did you then get offered some kind of support? So like family therapy or individual child therapy or counselling or anything like that to kind of support you while you're waiting for the next steps?
So they offered all of these things and I said yes to all of these things, but they didn't come until after the second assessment.
So yeah. You went a year without nothing, basically?
Yeah, literally. Well, I went 2 years without anything.
2 years?
Yeah, well, the first assessment was just kind of, it was no different to the GP assessment, kind of, for me. It was just literally, it was going there, we sat in the same room, but I remember it just literally being very quick.
Do you feel like they didn't take enough time to find out who you really was and what you was going through?
I think they did more in the second assessment, which is what I think is the approval. Because it's more of like, say, for example, are you living in your actual preferred name now? Are all the things changed to your preferred name? It's more of that, because if they weren't, they'd kind of be like, so are you sure about this kind of thing? So because you're not really living in. You see what I mean?
It's
so
kind of like a test to see if this is really what you want to do.
If this is really what you want to do, then you'll go and change your name on all of this and you'll come back and your name will be changed and this and that. And, you know, so, yeah, they basically don't want to make the wrong decision, which is fair enough, but it's very long. It's very, very long.
This is a common feature of trans healthcare. Individuals are often required to undergo a real life experience to prove that they truly need the support.
He was kind of asking like, so what toilets do you use?
Oh.
He was asking like a lot of questions like that.
So a bit more intrusive.
Yeah, a bit more intrusive and a bit more personal.
Now, whilst it's really important to ensure that individuals have informed consent over their healthcare, our current system means that people face a lot of scrutiny just to decide about what to do with their own bodies.
But it's not even just the grilling. I feel like, honestly, the assessments are kind of like a lot as well. And it's very overwhelming to have someone asking you kind of like, are you sure about this? Like, I wouldn't have thrown myself out of this situation if I didn't know, if that makes sense.
They find themselves and their identities challenged, often when they've already been through years of reflecting and waiting to access the services they need.
Like, I have had a lecture from my grandma before this, so I am ready for this.
100%. The philosophy of having trans people prove who they are plays to the narrative that there's a high level of regret amongst trans people after transitioning. Even though it's important that people have informed consent over any medical procedure, evidence strongly suggests allowing individuals with gender dysphoria to access good healthcare is the number one predictor of improving their quality of life.
If you feel it, why should you have to be put under so much scrutiny?
The feelings never ever change, so I'll never ever be like, I'm sure this is what I wanted. It was kind of the realization of, I am not who I am, so who am I?
Unfortunately, in April, Liz Truss, the Women and Equalities Minister in Boris Johnson's cabinet, suggested that reforms to the Gender Recognition Act would need to involve appropriate checks and balances on access to healthcare for young trans people. This is especially worrying because the Gender Recognition Act is not about accessing medical procedures. It's simply a piece of law that allows an individual to legally change their name and pronouns.
At the moment, you have to get a medical certificate and you have to show that you have lived for 2 years in the gender to which you wish to be assigned, the required gender. Is Labour going to remove those requirements and allow people to completely self-identify?
I mean, Andrew, this is a really sensitive point. And if you look at the amount of young people that are, you know, the suicide rates amongst young people, especially from transgender backgrounds, is really a scourge on society.
This is Angela Rayner, Deputy Labour leader.
And anyone watching this show, I don't want them to be offended that somehow we're saying that they're choosing to be a particular gender. That's not how it feels for people that are going through that process. What we're saying is we'll be sensitive under the Gender Recognition Act to ensure that people can be valued of who they are and protect their rights, whether that's women, whether that's transgender women, whether that's men or whether that's girls. And we will make sure that everybody feels valued as part of a society and tolerant.
Keir Starmer, the current Labour leader, has spoken openly about his desire to make the system easier for trans individuals, making it easier to change their names legally, and to make sure there is space in the Gender Recognition Act for non-binary people, meaning that they don't find themselves in a restricted male-female space, but instead with legalisation that caters for people across the gender spectrum. In my opinion, this is the kind of policy appropriate to 2020, where we're not policing people's gender presentation or putting them into specific categories, but instead allowing them to make the choices about who they are and who they want to be. I came across this in an interesting way with Jordan in the interview, who doesn't feel particularly connected to the LGBT plus community, and feels the stigmatisation of the trans identity has challenged his legitimacy as a man.
But I just wanted to know a bit more about that. So do you feel that you're not part of the trans community?
Yeah, because I feel like when you kind of label it like that, it kind of takes it away from just being a normal person, if that makes sense. So it's almost like the LGBT, they kind of are sectioned away in a way of like, these guys are different people because this is the way they seem. They're not, you know, they're not straight, so they're just not really. So obviously they have more of a expanded mind and they're a bit crazy and a bit wild and all of these kind of things. But that's what I think is the issue, because everyone kind of has this kind of like stigma on LGBTQ plus, and it's like, just drop the stigma and just everyone just be yourself. Like, I feel like everyone's just here to live your life, and everyone's out here kind of putting you in a category, and you know, and you don't actually need a category. I feel like you really don't need a category, you just need to just do you. But I feel like, because it's always been like that in my head, like for my whole life, so why should I now, because I've realized now it's now called a certain name, now I have to go by that certain name? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Because in my head, I've always been mandem. I've never worn a skirt to school at all, like ever. I've never worn a dress. I've never ever worn any. I've never worn a bra. I've only worn sports bras. All these things. But this is what I'm saying. Like, why is it now? Because someone's called me with gender dysphoria, and now it's under a category which is transgender, and now it's this, and now it's that. But in my head, I've just been mandem. So yeah, so I know I'm classed as like transgender, but me myself, I see myself as mandem. I don't see myself as like a trans man. And even the whole explaining thing, like, because the other day I had to explain to, because at work I'm Jordan and stuff, but they don't know the situation at all. So I can come across as like a really young guy, like with no deep voice, no beard. And it's like, everyone's looking at me like,
he's this little baby.
Who's this guy? Yeah, he's this baby. And he's driving all these nice Range Rovers. And like, who's this guy? Like, but I told this guy the other day, because he was like kind of really onto me about it. He was really, you know, like, everyone doesn't really know if you're a girl or a boy. And I kind of trusted him a bit. And I was like, do you know what? I'm going to let you into a secret, yo. It shouldn't change like the way you perceive me. After I told him that, he actually started slipping up on the whole pronoun thing.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So this is the reason as to why I never let anyone know the whole... Because this is what I'm saying. The minute you put yourself in that category, the minute you're different to everyone else, and the minute you're actually LGBTQ and that's it, because you've got a different mind to us, if that makes sense.
Yeah. In my research into these issues, I found that the NHS offers free egg freezing for cancer patients whose fertility might be compromised by treatment. However, they don't offer free egg freezing for trans people. I wanted to ask Jordan about this and the process, as I knew he was seeking egg freezing.
The second assessment I probably had in 2018, mm-hmm. and they approved me to have my hormones. So I could have started hormones then and there, but I've not started because I want to freeze my eggs. Mm-hmm. But because it's the NHS in our area, well, down in South, they don't support, like they wouldn't fund it fully because of... it's just not needed in a way. It's kind of like a luxury for them.
Yeah, so I heard that funding decisions about storage and fertility treatment are decided locally. Mm. So, yeah. As you said, based on your area, and they don't have to fund it if they don't think that they need to.
Yeah, they don't want to. Yeah. So because they never funded it, we were just left with like that kind of toll of, all right, cool. So when are we going to sort this out? But for me, I feel like it's very important that I have my own kids, because that kind of goes along the whole lines of just being not normal, but just not being in that category of, not being in the category of just not being able to do all these things. And because I don't have a problem with adopting, I'll still adopt, but it's different when, you know, you have your own child who's got like the same genetics as you and certain things. And what's really annoying is we're just about to get this started like this month or next month, but because of this whole coronavirus
killing it, my gosh,
killing the whole process. So I don't even know what's going on at the moment, but the whole process in, because the clinic we started doing it, they were charging us I think $9,000 for the whole process.
Wow.
And then you'd have to obviously pay per year to keep it in there. And so it's quite a lot of pressure, and it's quite a lot to even get your head over. Just, this is what I'm saying, because this baby's going to be like a magical baby.
Yeah,
like
baby literally.
Just be, yeah, like this baby's got to be walking on Gucci and stuff. Like.
But obviously the positive is like after freezing it, and if it works, it means that you can carry the baby if you wanted to, or obviously your partner going forward in the future.
Yeah, exactly. And it would also just be, I don't want to keep coming back to this normal thing, but it's just kind of like without dehumanizing the situation.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
It's like a normal process. Like, yeah, it's not, you don't have to do anything abnormal for someone who decides they want to have a kid. Yeah, I completely get that. Something that the Labour leaders are looking at doing is implementing free egg freezing for all like trans people and gender fluid people. So is that something that you think should be done?
Yeah, 100%, 110%. Because it's just like, to be fair, like that's another dehumanizing thing. Because it's like the minute you come to NHS and they're like, we're not going to do this because this is like, you know, this is like us helping you out for something that you don't really need, kind of thing. So for Labour to actually make that happen, it will kind of change it in a way where it's, like I said, not dehumanising, it's just normal. So it's just, you know, I just go to NHS now and I know they're going to pay for it rather than me having this anxiety of, oh, I don't know what's going on. I don't know, you know, it's very overwhelming in that whole don't really know stage.
I really hope that happens.
I just think it's weird that it's also down to the area. I think that's quite weird. Why is it down to the area? Because surely if it's NHS, surely you should just make it a
centralized
rule. Yeah. Like, why is it down to like one person, one manager and one like situation? And like that doesn't even sound fair as it is.
It gives a lot of power to specific people, which I think in situations where it's about someone's, first of all, health, well-being and, you know, them feeling more like themselves so they can be happier. I don't think that should be dependent on someone else's discretion.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I actually agree with that.
I have one more question for you. What do you think the NHS could do to assist individuals with their journey of gender self-discovery?
I think, honestly, it should be a thing where from a very young age, because the thing is, you can see like gender fluidity in like very young kids, because they don't know any better, but you'll see them act like, you know, they'll act like themselves and they'll be very flamboyant and all over the place. And because I know I was when I was young, and I put it out there that I was like a mini guy. And I feel like if I had someone at that age kind of asking the questions of, do you know who you are, but just how do you feel basically? Because I feel like when you're a child, you don't really think about those things. And then the minute you get into like a young adult, it's like it hits you all in the face because you haven't thought about it. Do you see what I'm saying?
So I feel
like if like NHS was there, even if they're doing like regular assessments of like young kids and stuff like that, of just seeing what, like, I don't know, how they feel or how they see themselves, or, you know, those kind of questions to kind of make them think about being themselves and stuff like that from a very young age, then I think it'll kind of prevent a lot more in the future, if that makes sense.
That definitely makes sense.
Because for me, I honestly don't want to go through any of this. Like, I wanted to be born this way, if that makes sense. I didn't want to actually have to reassign myself. And I can't really explain, like, properly, like, to someone who doesn't really, I don't know. It's quite hard to explain, to be fair. You can be whoever you want to be and you don't actually need someone to dictate who you are.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Interconnected Voices. This episode features Jordan Palmer. To find out more about Interconnected Voices, follow @interconnected_voices on Instagram. Until next time, stay home and stay safe.